Hi, I'm Marco Werman at The World. We've been asking listeners and readers for support as we cover one of the biggest stories of our time. Thank you for the many messages of gratitude and encouragement, and yes, financial support as well. There are many worthy places seeking your help during this pandemic. If you think independent and accurate journalism is part of the solution, now is a good time to show your support for The World. Right now, all contributions will be matched by an anonymous donor who believes in fair, free global reporting. That means your gift of $50 will provide $100 of support for The World's coverage. Our journalism has never been behind a paywall, but it does cost money to bring you these important stories, reported with nuance, context, and voices from the front lines of our interconnected world. We are asking for your support to make sure this essential reporting remains freely available, always, for everyone. We're grateful when you listen to public radio, and especially grateful for your support of The World's nonprofit journalism. And you have a unique opportunity right now to double the impact of your financial support. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute today, while your gift will have twice the impact. Or follow the link right here in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. All medical hands on deck. Thousands of nurses and doctors battling COVID-19 in the U.S. are unauthorized immigrants, but working here legally. The Trump administration wants to end that.
If all of a sudden I don't have a work permit, I don't know, I can't legally work as a nurse.
Also, a novelist locked down in Rome now has to deal with a nonfiction world.
I've kept my eyes fixed on reality for 50 days, which never happens to me because I'm a fiction writer.
And a tip to fight social isolation, start a virtual jam session. This woman got someone to start, then others joined in on their own instruments.
And I would play along as if we were playing in the same place together. And it made me feel as if we were.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Seven days in the hospital, 3 days in intensive care. But British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is now home. Johnson was the first national leader in the world to be hospitalized with COVID-19. He released a video thanking National Health Service workers, specifically two nurses, whom he says stood by his bedside for 48 hours.
They're Jenny from New Zealand, Invercargill on the South Island to be exact, and Luis from Portugal near Porto. And the reason in the end my body did start to get enough oxygen was because for every second of the night, they were watching and they were thinking and they were caring and making the interventions I needed.
This highlights a reality of the healthcare profession in the UK and around much of the world. Many of the doctors, nurses, and medical technicians in the fight against COVID-19 are immigrants. In the U.S., some 30,000 are undocumented, but they've got work permits because of DACA, the Obama-era program that gives legal status to qualified applicants who were brought to the U.S. as children. Now, however, their ability to continue working could hinge on a Supreme Court decision about whether the Trump administration can shut the program down. The World's Marnette Fedaris has our story.
Jessica Esparza started her new job as an ICU nurse in March, just as the coronavirus started sweeping through the U.S. She found herself caring for COVID-19 patients.
I think my anxiety to go to work has jumped, you know, way, way up there, because I already was jumping into a new unit. And then all of a sudden it's like, here's a pandemic and we don't really know exactly what's happening and how or where this is going to go.
Esparza is 27 years old and works in Wenatchee, Washington, about 2 hours east of Seattle. But the outbreak is not her only worry. Esparza has DACA, short for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Esparza's mother brought her to the U.S. from Mexico without authorization when she was 11. DACA allows Esparza to work in the U.S. legally. She calls DACA a lifesaver because it let her have a career and worry less about deportation.
If DACA had not come through, there is no way that I could have become a nursing assistant and then apply to the nursing program.
But now the Supreme Court is deciding whether the government can end DACA. The ruling could come any day now, through June. The Trump administration says DACA was always temporary, and it has every right to end it. Opponents say the way the government wants to end the program is illegal, and that it's not considering that the 700,000 or so DACA recipients have lived most of their lives in the U.S. If the court rules in favor of the government, thousands of DACA recipients and thousands of health workers like Esparza might lose their freedom to work here legally.
If all of a sudden I don't have a work permit, I don't know, you know, I can't legally work as a nurse, so I'm not sure where that leaves me.
Mark Kachowski, a medical school professor at Loyola University in Chicago, says ending DACA would be devastating.
Who wins? Who possibly wins in that situation?
That's because Kachowski says even before the pandemic, there was already a doctors and nurses shortage in the U.S., especially in rural areas. And he says DACA health workers are key to helping fight the pandemic. They have the life experiences and language skills to reach people in vulnerable communities, places being hit hard by the coronavirus.
They understand the immigrant experience. They're bicultural, bilingual, who can get the trust of these communities as we need communities to listen to advice, to come in and be treated.
Dr. Nu Lativongskorn, who migrated from Thailand with his family when he was 9, went into medicine so he could treat patients from underserved communities. Today, he's a first-year resident at a public hospital in San Francisco. He'll soon work in the emergency room, where he expects to treat people who have the coronavirus.
It is only a matter of when.
He says he's ready, and it's all part of being an essential worker during a health crisis. He feels that people like him, who have spent most of their lives in the U.S., should be offered a path to citizenship.
For our country to then not really have our back, and be questioning whether or not we should even be here in the first place, that's really unfortunate and cruel.
The work permit that Lativongskorn got through DACA expires in August. He hopes to renew it soon and maybe safeguard his ability to work if the Supreme Court doesn't go his way. But renewing the permit isn't easy now.
And that's another thing that's up in the air. Immigration has announced that they were closing offices during this time. And so there's angst around what that means for renewals for DACA.
In the meantime, many DACA recipients are just trying to focus on how they can help during the pandemic. Denise Rojas is a medical student currently in Boston. When she's not studying, she's volunteering, logging in at 6 a.m. every day to help a hospital track down and obtain medical equipment. She also works a telehealth line, answering questions, sometimes in Spanish, about the coronavirus from uninsured patients.
I truly hope that the Supreme Court understands the valuable contributions that we have in the society every day.
Esparza, the nurse in Washington, is focusing her energies on her patients.
They don't care what my legal status is in this country.
She says they only care that she has the ability and training to care for them. For the World, I'm Arnett Fideris.
The U.S. is now the center of the global pandemic, with more than 500,000 confirmed cases and 22,000 deaths from COVID-19, and a surge still on the way for many parts of the country. It seems premature to talk about opening things back up, but that's what President Trump says he wants. Today on Twitter, Trump said he would consult with governors, but ultimately he says it is the decision of the president. This question, when to reopen schools and businesses, is being debated across the globe. Michael Ryan, who directs the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Program, offered some caution.
As we come out of these lockdown situations, we may see a jump back up in cases, and we don't want to lurch from lockdown to nothing to lockdown to nothing. We need to have a much more stable exit strategy.
Spain is debating its exit strategy. Some manufacturing and construction firms are now reopening near Madrid. It's only a partial lifting, though. Most Spaniards remain stuck at home. And Spain's lockdown restrictions are among the tightest in Europe. Apartment dwellers in Madrid are not even allowed to go on their rooftops for fresh air, much less go for a non-essential stroll around the block. Beatriz García Ríos is a landscape architect in Spain's capital.
We can't even go around the block to get some air. So it's really difficult to think about people going to work. I imagine people must be a bit scared, the ones that are going to work today. But the economical situation is so hard that maybe they have to try and open up a bit to see how it goes.
Yeah, as a landscape architect, I imagine some of your work has to happen outside, but are you feeling like you would want to return to your office right now?
I would, yes, but I don't have to work in a closed space with people around me all the time.
What would you want the Spanish government to do that it is not doing that would help you strike the balance between being protected from the disease and also protecting your ability to make a living?
They should communicate better, and they should try to make decisions based more on data. We don't have enough data. The countries that have been doing better are the ones that have more information, and definitely Spain is not one of them at the moment.
Personally, Beatriz, in your everyday life, do you feel safer now than a few weeks ago when there was less known about the disease?
I don't feel safe. I'm trying not to read too much at the moment because it's so contradictory. And you get one expert saying one thing and then another saying something very different. And then in the end, if you do everything they tell you to do, it gets you absolutely paralyzed.
You live in downtown Madrid, pretty close, I understand, to one of the city's main hospitals. I imagine you're hearing the sirens every day. What has that been like?
I have not one, but two of the biggest hospitals in Madrid right down the street. And I live with the sirens all the time. But now there is no traffic, so they don't need to put the sirens on because there are no cars.
Beatriz, when the restrictions are eventually lifted, what is the first thing you'll go out and do in Madrid? What are you most missing and what are you looking forward to?
See my family. Hug them. I think that's what we all want. And just to have a beer with somebody, sit on a sidewalk. It's like a dream.
Best keep that dream alive. I share it with you, Beatriz.
Okay, thank you.
Beatriz Garcia Rios, a resident of Madrid. She's also a landscape architect. I hope you can get back to work real soon. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Here on the show, we've been sharing some advice on how to survive social isolation, like those two women we heard from last week in a cabin near the Arctic Circle for months. That certainly put things in perspective. Today, we hear from someone very used to living far away from friends and family, like about as far away as you can get. Here's the world's Amanda McGowan.
When astronaut Katie Coleman was living on the International Space Station, she'd often look out the window and down at Earth.
I felt close. I mean, you look down and Earth is right there and it's only 250 miles away. I mean, it's really not so far away. It's just you can't get there.
Coleman lived on the space station for 6 months, and that's a long time to be far from home. So, like a lot of us are doing right now, she made a big effort to feel as close as she could by staying connected. She called loved ones from the special phone on board, and she also did this. Coleman is a flute player. She's actually played in not one, but two all-astronaut bands. And she figured out a creative way to practice with them from space. Kind of.
And so I took the MP3s that I had of our band playing different songs, and I would put that on the computer, and I would be up in the cupola, which is our window on the world. It's got these, you know, windows all around and a big one right up top. And I would listen to that music and play along as if we were playing in the same place together. And it made me feel as if we were.
But space isn't just one big concert in the sky all the time. An astronaut's days are filled with lots of tasks that don't have immediate payoffs. Organizing food, doing maintenance on the space station, conducting physics experiments. Coleman says she had to remind herself that all of these things, over time, would contribute to the mission, setting the stage for future exploration of places like the moon and Mars. And Coleman says this idea, mundane tasks adding up to something bigger, that's where space and this current pandemic are sort of alike.
What does this action that I'm taking right now, what does it really mean? What does it mean if I wash my hands one more time when I know I should, but I don't really feel like it, and does it make a difference?
Coleman says, yes, it does make a difference. Washing your hands or telling a loved one not to go out, these things really matter.
The steps may not be, they may not be exciting. You know, we may not be able to stand up and say, I figured out the vaccine for the virus. But the fact that we stay home, the fact that we figure out how we can help other people, every one of those actions counts. There's no question in my mind.
Washing your hands, it's not rocket science. But right now, it's all part of the mission. For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
You're listening to The World. We know you value what we do here at The World. Right now, during the outbreak of COVID-19, our global coverage is a critical source of information for listeners and readers. Today, we are asking you to support our freely available fact-based reporting. When you support The World, your donation will be doubled by an anonymous donor who, like you, values the important stories, global context, and critical voices we bring you every weekday from the front lines of our interconnected world. These days, more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking you to help support it and have your donation matched. Go to theworld.org/give. And don't forget, your donation will be doubled by an anonymous supporter. If you have never contributed to The World before, now is the time to give. That's theworld.org/give. And thank you. Italy has reason to hope. On Sunday, Italian officials recorded the lowest number of new COVID-19 deaths in 3 weeks, 431 in a 24-hour period. It still sounds bleak, but it could mean the spread of disease is starting to decline. Paolo Giordano has been writing about the pandemic from Rome for the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera. His reports have been quickly turned into a book, which is available now in English. It's called How Contagion Works: Science, Awareness, and Community in Times of Global Crisis. Paolo, you've written that there are three stages of a pandemic: strength, sacrifice, and patience. Which stage is Italy in at the moment?
I think Italy is at the beginning of the patience moment, because the curve is actually flattening, but it's very slow. The descent is much slower than the ascent. We are realizing that it's going to take a long time before we can go out and live a sort of normality again. So I think this is also a very dangerous and tricky moment, because 1 month ago, the motivation for people was very strong because we had that shocking images coming from the north of Italy from hospitals, or the coffins being taken away by the army because there was not enough space anymore. So it was very easy to do your best for the situation. But after a month, people are starting to suffer from this lockdown and from real actual problem. We need a new motivation to resist.
What do you suggest that be?
I think it's the time for a narrative coming from the government, basically, about what is ahead of us. So now we need to know that things will come again, in what order, more or less in what time, even though nobody really knows exactly when this will be over. But we need a horizon to look at. We really need a plan now.
What are the lockdown rules in Rome like right now? Do you get to go outside each day?
I haven't been out for many, many days. My wife goes shopping for groceries, and that's it.
When you look outside your window, Paolo, what do you see right now? Are there any people on the street?
No, not really. I don't actually see a street. So I see the roofs, and there are more people on the roofs. The roofs and terraces have become a very precious thing for those who have one. I have a very, very small balcony. Just one by one, we can stay there, but we take turns.
Mm. Where do you live in Rome?
I live quite close to the center. Even the last time I was out was beginning of March. There was nobody in the streets. I mean, I passed by the Colosseum because there's a park there where I usually go running. And it was probably the first time I didn't see anybody there. But I could have been struck by the beauty of it. But I have to say that I was instead a little sad that there was nobody.
The fact that Italians are now forcibly separated from one another, has that in some way brought Italians together as a nation?
Yes, it definitely did. And I think the same is happening a little everywhere, maybe a little more in Italy, because we were the first Western country to be affected so much. So there was also a sort of loneliness, if I can put it that way.
How has this pandemic changed you, Paolo?
I've kept my eyes fixed on reality for 50 days now or so, which never happens to me because I'm a fiction writer. So I usually tend to escape from your reality, and now I cannot simply stop staring at everything that happens, and I'm just dependent on the news, and I don't know. The long-term change is very difficult to see from here. I don't know. I have a feeling that I'm looking for like deeper explanations than before, and then I'm becoming more selective. What I want to listen to, what I want to read, what I want to talk about. I know it's a passage. I mean, it will go away and they will be exactly the same probably, but right now there is a change.
Sounds like it's made you more keen of the finiteness of time and life.
I think it did. There will be a before and an after this, not only in Italy, worldwide. And it's very strange to see that the whole world is living the same situation, but we're not in sync. So eventually everybody will go through this and the whole world will be affected very strongly. And I think it's the first time something like this happens. There's also a sense of being all together in one thing for the first time.
Paolo Giordano is a former physicist, now a writer. He lives in Rome. His essay about the current pandemic is How Contagion Works, Science, Awareness, and Community in Times of Global Crisis. Paolo, thank you very much for your time and for writing such a clear-eyed approach to understanding how this virus really affects us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for the conversation.
The coronavirus pandemic has placed incredible pressure on health systems across the globe. The World is hosting a new weekly discussion series with the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We're taking your questions to the experts. Tomorrow at noon Eastern, The World's Ilana Gordon will moderate a conversation with Dr. Caroline Buckey, an associate professor of epidemiology at Harvard. Head to our Facebook page to add your questions, and you can stream the conversation live at theworld.org. That's tomorrow at noon Eastern at theworld.org. Boredom under lockdown is starting to get to many of us. Australians especially seem to be getting a little loony.
I'm too sexy for my bed. Ooh, I'm too sexy.
The voice you're hearing there is definitely not Right Said Fred. He's the I'm too sexy one-hit wonder guy. That 74-year-old Australian Helen Smart wearing a long, fuzzy purple housecoat suggesting that a striptease is coming as she rolls her garbage can to the street. Ms. Smart posted a video of her singing and dancing to the Facebook group Bin Isolation Outings. Desperate times call for desperate Facebook groups, I guess. Like this man who dressed in a long black coat as Jon Snow from Game of Thrones, complete with sword, as he retrieves his garbage can.
We must collect the Brins, brothers. For Binter is coming. When you play the Game of Thrones, you bin or you die. Open the gates!
Hashtag Binter is coming. The Bin Isolation Outings group has only been around for about 2 weeks. Already it has more than 700,000 members. People have dressed up as witches, superheroes, Edward Scissorhands, an emoji poop, and the Easter Bunny. In one video, Obi-Wan uses the Force to magically deliver his bin to the curb. In another, two jockeys race bins on wheels down a driveway. And then there's this guy.
It's a little bit funny. You stop here inside. I'm in isolation and I'm getting wild.
When he finally gets to the curb, his tune changes to Goodbye Yellow Top Bin. I guess if we still have to take out the trash and that's the only outdoors time we get, might as well make the most of it.
I'm too sexy for my love, too sexy for my love, love's going to leave me.
News headlines are coming up next. You're listening to The World. Empty churches across the world on Easter Sunday. Some religions are taking the pandemic more seriously than others. The Mormon Church is recalling its missionaries.
It's a bittersweet kind of thing, I guess. It's nice being home, and of course, missing home. I was gone 15 months, so quite a while.
And on a completely unrelated note, in Finland, they're partying alone in their underwear. The story's ahead on The World. If you look at a world map where the coronavirus has spread, South America has fewer dots than most of the planet. Only one nation has more than 10,000 reported cases, Brazil. Still, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has consistently downplayed the threat. As Richard Kemeny reports from Sao Paulo, that's not the only thing making the outbreak difficult to tackle.
Right from the start, Jair Bolsonaro dismissed the idea that the coronavirus would be a big deal. Even after news of Brazil's first death from COVID-19 in mid-March, the president brushed it off as a little flu. He attacked the media and called preventative actions hysteria.
O que tínhamos que conter naquele momento era o pânico, a histeria e...
Brazilians will have a natural immunity to the virus, Bolsonaro suggested. They can dive into a sewer and not catch anything. Eventually, the president did change his tone on the coronavirus.
Mas agora estamos diante do maior desafio da nossa geração. Minha preocupação sempre foi salvar vidas.
It's the biggest challenge of our generation, Bolsonaro called it in early April.
Parlamento, judiciário, governadores, prefeitos.
And he went on to call for unity in response to the threat. But health experts say it's too little, too late.
It's difficult to measure, but this attitude influenced a lot of Brazilians. Many people still believe that we're exaggerating the risk in some way.
That's Fernando Spilky, president of the Brazilian Virology Association.
In truth, the risk is real and big. We're passing through one of humanity's biggest challenges since the Second World War, and some people still aren't convinced of that. Now, there's little we can do other than trying to prevent the spread of the disease.
It took almost a month to register 1,000 COVID-19 cases in Brazil. 3 days later, that number had doubled. Case numbers have continued to rise into April. The majority are in the southeast of the country, though hotspots are developing in the northeast and in the Amazon as well. Spilky says Brazil is probably in the early stages of this pandemic. Shortages of medical equipment and delays with testing mean the real numbers are likely to be far higher than the official ones.
Considering that we are only testing severe cases, we can estimate that the real number will be something like 5 times more.
That's Luciana da Costa, Deputy Director of the Institute of Microbiology at the University of Rio de Janeiro. She says years of cuts in science funding have put Brazil in a bad position to fight this outbreak. And in March, a fresh round of cuts directly affected scientists already studying the new coronavirus.
We're not testing everybody that needs to be tested because we don't have enough tests to do it. We don't have enough labs that are able to do the tests, and we don't have enough trained personnel to conduct the tests.
Meanwhile, in Sao Paulo, hundreds of bodies are filling up graveyards. Many are suspected of dying from COVID-19, but test results were slow to materialize. Brazil faces another set of compounding problems. The temperature, particularly in the hard-hit southeast, is set to drop at the end of April, when the peak of the virus is predicted. Fernando Spilky says that's likely to make things worse.
We still haven't arrived at the coldest part of the year, which normally for us is a very intense period for respiratory problems. Sometimes it lasts until August. We have to wait for the next few weeks to understand how this pandemic is going to behave here.
Brazil has already seen an alarming number of cases of dengue fever. The flu season is also just beginning here. Experts worry that the peak of all three could happen at the same time later this month. That would put a huge strain on the country's already fragile public health system. Though the worst is yet to come, there are some positive signs. In Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, precautionary measures taken by state governors appear to be flattening the curve. Again, Costa says, without adequate testing, it's impossible to say what exactly lies ahead. But projections are stark.
Eventually, we will get to the several hundred thousand cases here in Brazil.
Since his call for unity, President Bolsonaro has threatened to fire government ministers who become stars. He has repeatedly clashed with his health minister, whose popularity has soared during the crisis as the president's has fallen. New Ministry of Health guidelines mean some lesser affected areas in the country could begin to relax social distancing policies from today. What effect this overall confusion will have on the virus's spread remains to be seen. Bolsonaro's persistent rejection of science comes at a time when the country needs it most. As many Brazilians see it, he's putting the country through a macabre experiment. For The World, I'm Richard Kemeny in Sao Paulo.
Brazil has agreed to hold back its oil supplies in an attempt to stabilize global markets. In total, 23 nations committed to reducing oil production, including the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Russia. There's been an oil glut because, well, you're aware, no one is going anywhere. Prices dropped, but the oil has kept on flowing. Gaurav Sharma is a financial writer based in London. He's focused on the oil and gas sector. Gaurav, President Trump tweeted out yesterday, the big oil deal with OPEC Plus is done. This will save hundreds of thousands of energy jobs in the United States. So let me ask you, will the deal really save all those jobs?
I think it's a very sweeping statement by the president. What we have here is a very tall claim. Those jobs could only be saved if the world gets a handle on the coronavirus and the economy starts bouncing back somewhere towards the end of the second quarter. But this deal in itself, it's not sufficient enough to save jobs because we're flying less, we're driving less, we're even consuming less. And that is very bad news for the oil industry.
So Trump has been a harsh critic of OPEC, as you know, but he and other U.S. officials were banging the phones hard this weekend to get something across the finish line with this deal. Why was this deal so important to Trump?
So the president has indulged in some phenomenal diplomacy over the course of the Easter weekend. And as a result of that, we have a deal of 9.7 million barrels per day. At one point on Thursday, it looked at like everything would collapse. And there was some phenomenal diplomacy by the White House, calling the Russians, calling the Saudis, calling the Mexicans. It's so important to the president because Texas is a key state for the president. And this is where we are. He wants to keep Texas, Oklahoma, places like the Dakotas and Alaska on board because these are huge oil and gas states, and hence his extraordinary intervention.
Does the deal at least soften the relationship now between the U.S. and OPEC? Will it lead to a new level of trust, do you think?
I think this is an association of convenience. At the same time that that the president is ringing Moscow and is ringing Riyadh, he's also sanctioned Moscow, or rather the U.S. government has. At the same time, he's also trying to say that too much cheap Saudi oil is flooding U.S. markets and that he might at some point consider slapping tariffs on them. He's cooled all of that down because of this deal, but I think the sort of geopolitical tensions, especially between Washington and Moscow, they're likely to persist because while Russia has acted for its own self-preservation, at least on paper, we'll see what the data says later down the year. So while Russia has acted in its own self-preservation, that does not for one moment ease the tensions between Moscow and Washington.
It sounds like you don't really see, Gaurav, consistency in Trump's oil policy.
I think the consistency is very hard to find. Whenever the president sort of takes the mantle on anything, keen followers of his Twitter account, which the president is quite fond of, would notice that just 12 months ago, the president was having a go at the Saudis, was having a go at OPEC, was having a go at oil producers in general, saying, come on, guys, you are pumping, you're controlling your pumps, you're lowering the flow of oil, and U.S. consumers are suffering. Let the free market prevail. What the president didn't forecast was there'd be a huge global pandemic. And as a courtesy of that pandemic, the free market is prevailing, but the oil and gas sector is bleeding. So I'm not convinced. There seems to be an abject lack of consistency. But then I guess self-preservation is the overriding factor here.
Gaurav Sharma is a London-based writer and blogger of the Oilholics Synonymous Report. Gaurav, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Over Easter weekend, the head of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, called on religious leaders of all faiths to work together to fight COVID-19.
Together, we can and will defeat this virus with cooperation, solidarity, and faith in our common humanity.
In many cases, solidarity means all faith leaders closing houses of worship, moving rituals online, and telling followers to stay home. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, is also taking an extraordinary step. They are calling thousands of young missionaries serving overseas back home. Naomi Zevoloff has our story.
I love you.
I love you.
I'm so glad you're home and safe.
It's been a while.
Connor Whitesides returned home to Syracuse, Utah from his mission in Peru last week. His neighbors came outside to their driveways to give him a warm welcome, but from a safe distance.
There's Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
Whiteside's mother recorded this video of Connor's homecoming. This is not what they had anticipated. Typically, LDS missionaries are greeted at the airport by family and friends. They come with signs and balloons to mark an important rite of passage for many young people in the church. Instead, Whiteside's met his parents in the airport parking lot and then drove to his childhood home, where he's now spending 2 weeks in quarantine.
It's a bittersweet kind of thing, I guess. It's nice being home and, of course, missing home. I was gone 15 months, so quite a while.
Whiteside's, who is 19, was supposed to be gone for 2 full years. For the moment, he's no longer a missionary, having been released from his duties. Before the coronavirus outbreak, there were more than 67,000 LDS missionaries serving around the world. Church officials say that many have been sent home already. Peyton Graham, another 19-year-old from Syracuse, was on a mission in Argentina.
I decided to serve a mission when I was pretty young. I started reading the Book of Mormon, another testament of Jesus Christ, and my testimony grew. And I felt the love of my Savior, Jesus Christ. I wanted to serve him and preach his gospel and share his love with those around me.
Missionary life is strict. They live in pairs, wake up at 6:30 in the morning, and spend long hours proselytizing on the street and in people's homes. They're not supposed to read mainstream news, listen to pop music, and calls back home are limited to once a week. When the coronavirus hit, Graham and his missionary companion started taking extra precautions, like giving fist bumps instead of handshakes. But soon, Argentina sent them into full-time quarantine. They tried to continue their missionary work.
We resorted to using the only source of technology that we had was a very old Nokia phone. But teaching a lesson over the phone about religion is not very effective without body language and being there in person and actually being able to talk to them.
To pass the time, Graham made videos documenting missionary life under quarantine.
Okay, 2 hours into quarantine, and we're going hard. Elder Gergich taking out stains on his shirt. What a beast. I sewed my shirt, my sleeve. Oh, it's horrible, but it's okay. And now we're going to feed Charlie, one of my favorite dogs here.
Now he's back home with his family. This isn't the first time that missionaries have been called home in large numbers. According to Artis Partial, a historian in Salt Lake City, it happened in World War II as well, when hundreds of LDS missionaries left Europe.
Most of the missionaries received telegrams saying it was time to get out, and they lost track of most of the missionaries between their mission apartments and when they actually crossed the border. They had to guess what trains missionaries might be on and try to meet them.
This evacuation has been much more organized. In some cases, the LDS Church chartered planes for homebound missionaries and gave open seats to stranded flyers trying to get home too. Some church members have watched the exodus and wondered if it is the fulfillment of prophecy. Brigham Young, one of the first Mormon leaders, predicted that the Lord would call missionaries back before the end of days. But Partial says she's not so sure that's happening now.
It's a reminder of what we expect will come sometime, but there's no reason to panic and believe that today is that day.
Now missionaries who've come home face uncertainty. The church is giving them an option for possible reassignment, maybe closer to home in the U.S. They could also sit tight and wait for an opportunity to go back to the country where they served. Heather Goff just returned to Ogden, Utah from Zimbabwe. She says learning that her mission would be cut short was really difficult for her and her companion.
My companion and I were studying at the time, and we both were physically sick when we heard. It was just unprecedented. We had no idea. We lost it for a while just because it was such a shock.
Goff says she's still trying to decide what's next. But she believes that everything happens for a reason.
The missionary work will slow down in a lot of nations just because there's fewer missionaries. But I know that this wouldn't happen if it wasn't the best thing for the world at this time. The Lord knew that this was going to happen, and he sent us all home for a reason. The work needs to go forward in a different way than it has been.
Meanwhile, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is still expanding overseas. At its recent annual conference, held without a live audience, church leaders announced plans to build 8 new temples. Only three of them are in the U.S. The others are in Argentina, China, Congo, Nigeria, and the first one in the Middle East, in Dubai. For The World, Naomi Zevaloff.
We started the program today talking about what it means to start lifting lockdowns. Politicians and business leaders are eager to get things back to normal, but lockdowns are effective in slowing the spread of disease. They've seen what tight controls can do to keep the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 down in Vietnam. It has just about 250 confirmed cases. Still, authorities there are taking no chances. People who do not follow the rules can be hit with a fine. Vietnamese-American writer Huynh Quy Duc is in Hanoi, and I asked him what lockdown is like in Vietnam.
Well, all restaurants, any services, anything non-essential is completely closed. The city is deserted. There are some restaurants that deliver food, but nothing is really open. Just the supermarkets, schools are closed down. There's no service, nothing. You can't do anything on the streets at all. The women who bicycle around trying to sell flowers for Easter have been arrested.
Wow. How does it actually work?
When you go outside, there are lots of people who work for the police that tell you, oh, put on your mask, go home, where are you going? They check on the streets. It's about $10 to be fined if you are not wearing a mask. But even people who are working like Grab Taxi or drivers on motorcycles who are delivering food, they get fined, and people are complaining about that.
I gather there are also fines for spreading fake news. How does that work?
Well, people are being watched here constantly, whether you post things on Facebook. Some people foolishly posted April Fool's Day and stuff, and they've been fined. The government is really strict on any of this. If you spread bad rumors, if you say things about the government as well, not complimentary, you could get visited by the government or the police.
Duc, how worried are you that this kind of government imposition right now could turn into something more insidious?
In some ways, The Vietnamese here are accepting the sort of strictness of the government and the big brother kind of attitudes around here because they are afraid of the virus situation. And so, you know, when I have visits from the police, I'm okay with that. They come and tell me they want to check and see whether I've been abroad, whether I've traveled. But they're very good at finding anybody who's been in contact with anyone who's tested positive. Within hours, they will find you. Just yesterday, they found a Colombian guy. Last week, somebody escaped from a hospital and went to a little village about an hour and a half away. Within hours, they find all these people, and they quarantine them all the time, and they quarantine all these places that have had, you know, lots of cases.
You're no stranger to war and disaster, Duc. You grew up in South Vietnam during the war. You covered the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. How does COVID-19 compare? What feels different?
Well, I grew up when there was this curfew every night at 10 o'clock. You're just at home, and you accept that because of the war, because of the threats and the dangers. But this is much more terrifying. Partly because you don't know who you got in contact with. The person standing next to you could have it, and you have nowhere to hide. So you have to go out and get your food and your milk or whatever, and then you stay away from people. You can't touch anything. People use toothpicks to use in the elevators. When I think of growing up in the war, it was something you accepted. And you knew it was a good reason. Now you know it's a good reason, but it's just that you don't know where the enemy is. You don't know where the virus is hit. And that's terrifying, and it's probably terrifying for people who have medical conditions that have to go to hospitals. That sort of thing, when I was growing up, I didn't think about it. It was just normal every day. Now it's just unending, and we don't know when it's going to happen, when it's going to be any better, any improvement.
Mm. Vietnamese-American writer Huynh Quy Duc in Hanoi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Marco. It's always a pleasure.
If you know just one thing about Finland, it's probably this.
Finland has replaced Norway as the happiest country in the world.
Finland is the world's happiest country for the second year in a row.
Finland is number one.
They're number one.
The Finns are happy people. And maybe, just maybe, it's because they mastered social distancing long before the coronavirus. The world's Bianca Hillier reports.
Relaxing at the end of a long day no longer means going to a bar for a drink. In Finland, though, this is not much of an issue. Tuomas Koskipa, co-founder of Finland's Fat Lizard Brewery, says Finnish drinks are traditionally enjoyed in a rather comfortable and informal setting.
Everyone knows what underwear is, and everyone knows what getting drunk is. So those things combined is kalsarikännit.
Kalsarikännit. It's the Finnish tradition of getting drunk at home in your underwear. And it loosely translates to pants drunk. A YouTube video with Finnish actor Christopher Weiss says the tradition goes by a few names.
Pants drunk, skivisloshed, underwear under the influence. In other countries, this behavior is known as a sign of depression. But over here, it means the party has merely only just started.
With Kalsarikännit, the party starts at home and stays at home. There's no intention of going out, which makes it different from the more common pregame with friends. The tradition is now gaining traction around the world as people are staying home due to the coronavirus. Pants drunk is trending internationally on social media, thanks in part to the Finnish alcohol company called Long Drink, which recently adopted pants drunk as part of their social marketing strategy.
I will demonstrate to you how to social distance like a true Finn.
That's Long Drink co-founder Mikael Taipala, who grew up in southern Finland. He says that while anyone, anywhere, can take part in Kalsarikännit, Finns are uniquely suited for the activity because they're used to being, well, exposed.
Sauna culture is a huge part of the Finnish culture, and the proper way of doing it is fully naked. We definitely have that comfortableness and of being in our underwear and just not being ashamed of it. But also the ironic stereotype of being these isolated people just in their homes drinking.
Brewery owner Tuomas Koskipa says the long, cold, and dark Finnish winters also create a perfect setting for Kalsarikännit.
People just get depressed and really stay at home, and that might lead to Kalsarikännit.
Some Finns insist that underwear is the only option when getting pants drunk. But Taipala says you can wear whatever makes you feel comfortable.
It's an outfit that you would never wear outside of your home. For many of the people, it might be in your underwear. It might be in your sweatpants.
Experts say they aren't sure how long we'll be stuck inside, so you might as well get as comfortable as possible. Whatever form that may take. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Yeah, all of us doing our best to stay comfortable right now. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. We will see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.